Hey there, this is Mr. Brewer, and you are listening to our classroom project we call Forgotonia. Now, we've explored a number of topics revolving around social problems we face in rural America. But just because we're studying problems in rural America doesn't mean everyone is miserable. In fact, rural places are awesome places to live, and there's endless amounts of great things going on. But here's our essential question today. Can one make the case that you are happier living in a small town than anywhere else? To find out, we were very fortunate to discuss this topic with author and Knox College psychology professor, Dr. Tim Kasser, who's well known for his research on happiness, which he's conducted over the past 20 years. He is the author of several books, such as 2002's The High Price of Materialism, and has even been featured in documentary films like 2011's Happy, which explores reasons why, even though the U.S. has the largest economy, we rank just 23rd in the happiest nations of the world. So, we got a lot to talk about on this edition of Forgotonia. So with me today is someone so nice. They are so nice that this person would never become a dentist. Her name is Kaylin Beekman. Kaylin is a sophomore at Cuba High School. Hey, Ms. Kaylin. Thanks for being on. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
So, Mr. Brewer, my name is Kaylin, and thanks for having me. I just drank a juice box, and my favorite movie is Almost Famous.
Oh, that's a good movie. Yeah. So that's like the essence of who you are. I drank a juice box, which I can see laying right there. What, can you share what flavor that is?
Fruit punch.
Very important. So fruit punch juice box. And Almost Famous. All right, very good. So, Ms. Kaylin, are you more of a small town or big city type? What do you think?
I personally love living in a small town just because of the close community.
Awesome. You know what? And if I answer this question, I think I'm a bit unique. I grew up in a metropolitan area of around 60,000 people. And rather than stay in that area or perhaps move to an even more populated city, I too moved to a small town of about 1,300 people. And the thing is, I love it. I could not see myself anywhere else. Oh, and do you want to know what I found out about small towns?
I'm sure you'll tell me no matter what. So what I say, so just tell me.
I found this out that the 2010 census found almost 60 million Americans are living in what they characterize as rural areas. Although these rural areas cover 97% of the nation's land, they have just 19% of population. And to put this in perspective, the 1920 census was the first time more people lived in urban areas than rural.
So when our country was founded, you might say we were pretty much a nation made up of mostly rural people. And Thomas Jefferson dreamed for us to stay that way. He thought that the nation of do-it-yourself farmers would be a pretty happy nation indeed.
Happy, yes, if you own property and pay taxes, but that is a topic, you know what, for another time.
And while many of us prefer small town living, can we make the case through research that we are happier?
This, my friends, is essentially what we asked our guest, Dr. Tim Kasser. Are we happier in a small town? Now, Dr. Kasser isn't going to come out and say, yes, rural living is the best. Research shows it. Case closed. It's not that simple. And remember from episodes past, as social science researchers, we should always be hesitant to accept simple answers, remembering that everything is typically complex.
Still, Mr. Brewer, when people learn about Dr. Kastner's, shall we say, interesting background, it does seem to indicate that he's pretty happy in a small town.
I know, good point. And this guy has not just experienced one form of rural living, but several.
I've lived out in the country now since 1992. I haven't even lived in a city as big as Cuba or Knoxville.
Oh, really?
Since then. Yeah, I lived out in an old, it was actually a really cool place. It was a 200-year-old restored grist mill that was turned into five apartments in upstate New York. And then I lived in Montana, 2.5 miles up a mountain road in a log cabin for a year. And then we lived on the Blackfeet Indian Reservation in Montana in basically a shack with no running water or phone for 3 months. And then we've lived here in Illinois now since 1995, And we live on 10 acres of land out in the country. So my kids go to a small rural high school, not unlike Cuba High School. But we aren't in any town or anything like that. You know, we're definitely out in the corn and the soybean fields, you know. So I certainly know what rural lifestyle is like. Yes. Yeah. At present, we have 3 barn cats, 4 goats, 2 of whom were just born 2 months ago. And then we have a donkey. And then right now we are down to 5 chickens because a fox and raccoon have knocked off 3 or 4 of them in the last few weeks. So actually just last weekend we were rebuilding the coop area to keep the fox and the raccoon out. So over the years we've also had dogs and we've had sheep. We had a pot-bellied pig for a little while. But sort of goats and chickens are our main thing.
Awesome, right? Dr. Kassler has goats and donkeys and free-range chickens. He definitely seems like one happy dude. And for a lot of people I know, Dr. Kassler's house sounds a lot like their dream house. I'm actually directing this comment towards my wife when I said this.
Yes, but that's not for everyone. I mean, just think of all the goat, donkey, and chicken poo everywhere. That is a great responsibility and doesn't necessarily make me happy when I think about it.
Which is why we need to understand what we mean when we say we are happy. According to Dr. Kassler, we must first define what happiness is.
Well, first I would distinguish between happiness and well-being. So for me, there's happiness, and happiness is a pleasant emotion, okay? It's a sense of that can vary between being content, which is sort of like low-level happiness, if you will, to being ecstatic, which is like really high-level happiness. But I think in all cases, what's happening when you're feeling happy is that there is this feeling like things are going right, okay? You know, emotions, as a psychologist, you know, I think of emotions as being something that our body tells us about how life is going. So if we're sad, we know that we've lost something that means something to us. If we're angry, we know we're frustrated and somebody's blocking something we're trying to do. If we're happy, it's an emotion that is saying, keep doing this, okay? Things are going, keep dating this person, keep playing this instrument, keep doing math or whatever it is that's making you happy. It's a sign to us as a sort of an internal feedback that tells us that this is a good path for us to stay on, okay? So I think of happiness as an emotion. Now, well-being to me is something broader than that. So, and happiness is part of well-being, okay? But it's only part of well-being. I mean, at a broader level, what well-being also involves is things like being satisfied with your life. Happiness is an emotion, but the idea of being satisfied is more an idea. It's a thought. It's a cognition that says, when I kind of look at my life and evaluate my life, I'm saying, yeah, this is okay. I think another aspect of well-being that's deeper is meaning. You know, there are many things that I've done in my life that feel very meaningful that don't necessarily make me happy, right? So if you've raised children, you know that it's certainly not happiness that you have every moment when you're raising children, right? But it's very meaningful, okay? It feels like you were really connected. It seems like you're doing something that has an important purpose that's worthwhile. And I think for us to have well-being, we need the happiness, we need the satisfaction, we also need the meaning. So that's how I tend to think of those things.
Okay, so we should say well-being instead of happiness, right? Like, we aren't exactly happy when we have to clean up after animals, but having those animals may positively impact our well-being.
Yes, and for our purposes, I suggest we change our essential question from, are we happier in a small town, to, do we experience more well-being in a small town?
And when it comes to well-being, Dr. Kassler looks at 4 essential needs all of us have that contribute to our well-being. feeling safe and secure, competent, relating to others, and autonomy.
And he'll not only explain these needs, but let's listen to how he feels rural areas do at meeting each one.
Well, my kids grew up in a rural area, you know, and I think this is something that I did not, but my kids did. And this is something I've certainly thought about. So let me back up and say what I think the theory of happiness is, if you will, or a theory of well-being. You know, so from the theoretical perspective that I come from as a psychologist, I think there are four needs that all people have. So just like, you know, the plants in my office need a certain amount of light or a certain amount of water and a certain kind of soil chemistry in order to grow and thrive. I don't think a plant can be happy, but, you know, to be well, right? From the perspective we use, people have four needs, psychological needs, that they have to have met in order to be happy and to thrive. And those needs are to feel safe and secure, so to feel like I've got enough food and nobody's going to shoot me and I've got a safe, warm place to sleep tonight, right? To feel competent, so you need to feel like you're a competent social science teacher, I need to feel like I'm a competent researcher, we both need to feel competent as fathers, but I don't need to feel competent at tennis because that doesn't matter to me, right? Relatedness, which is the need to feel like close and connected and loved. And then finally, the need for autonomy, which is the need to feel like I'm choosing what I'm doing instead of forced to do something. So, you know, you'll feel very different coming here and interviewing me if it's something that you chose to do, as opposed to if it's something your principal told you you had to do, or you get fired, right? Okay. So from our perspective, if those four needs are being well met in a particular individual's life or at a particular moment, then that individual is likely to feel happy. But if any one or more of those four needs are not being well met, then the person is not so likely to be happy, okay? So for me, the question that you asked about urban and rural differences boils down to, is there any difference between those geographical locations and the ability to meet people's needs, right? Now, I think in terms of safety and security, that rural areas like Cuba and Knoxville probably do a pretty good job compared to lots of urban areas. On the other hand, there are some very, very poor parts. If you take a look at a map of poor parts of the United States, many of them are in very rural areas, right? Southern Illinois actually is having a lot of trouble right now in that respect. And so I think, you know, there probably are some rural areas which do a pretty good job of helping people feel safe and secure, others that maybe don't. And I think the same is true for urban areas, right? I think if you take a look at competence needs, I think that there are some ways in which I think a rural area can do pretty well. I once read an article a long time ago that said that something like 90% of US presidents have come from small towns. When you think about like Bill Clinton in Hope, Arkansas, you know, or a lot, you know, Harry Truman from wherever he was in Missouri, Hannibal, right?
Independence,
Missouri, right. Yeah. And the idea that the guy, that whoever was the author of this was saying was that by being in these small towns, they could kind of be, when they were kids, they could be big fish in a small pond. Right? You know, they could be like the best football player or the best, you know, because there wasn't nearly so much competition like you see in a big city, right? And there's not, one of the things that psychologists study is something called social comparison, and especially upward social comparison. So if I always think there's somebody who's better than me or smarter than me, I'm not going to feel so good, right? And so I think that, you know, rural areas are actually a place where kids can build a lot of competence, perhaps, if there are the opportunities for them to build the competence, right? Like if they want to be able to play violin and there's no violin teacher, then they might have a problem, right? Relatedness, again, I think a rural area has the chance to do pretty well at that. You know, when you take a look, everybody knows you, you know, you can have connections with other people. You know, there's not sort of the anonymity that you have in a big city. Then I think, I think about my kids. I'll just tell you a story. When my son was probably in middle school, he came home one day and he said, there's a new kid who came into Knoxville this last week. And we said, oh, what's that like? And he's like, well, I really feel bad for kids who come to Knoxville who are new. He said, it takes at least 3 days before you can make friends. And we just laughed, because 3 days is nothing, right? A lot of places you go, it's really hard to get in, but I think Dustin and Lucas, my sons, they knew pretty much everybody in their high school. And, there was, not that they liked everybody and not that they were friends with everybody, but there was that sense of connection, I think, that you can get. On the other hand, if you're a real oddball in a small town, I think that can really be more difficult for you in a small town than in a big city, and interfere with your ability to kind of find a group to fit in with, right? And I think last, autonomy, being able to do, to choose to do the things you want to do. I mean, I do think at one level, I believe that a rural area can be just as good as an urban area in that respect, okay? Because a lot of that has to do with how authority figures treat you. I mean, do your parents and your teachers and your coaches give you choices? And whether that's a rural football team or an urban football team, I don't think it really matters, right? But I do think that one of the places where a rural area maybe has a little more trouble is getting all of the different opportunities that kids might want to have and that they want to pursue, right? The opportunities oftentimes are more limited, in terms of which sports teams are offered, for example, or, are there AP classes, or are, how many terms of art can you take, or et cetera, right? And that can sometimes be a block for people because it's hard for them to pursue their interests. And when you're interested in something, you almost always feel autonomous about pursuing it, right? Mm-hmm. And so so I do think that's one of the places where an urban area might be a little bit easier to satisfy that need than a rural. But that's not to say that it can't be satisfied in a rural area. It's just there are fewer options sometimes.
Hey, did you hear that? 90% of US presidents come from small towns, so I have a better chance of being the next president than 80% of other Americans just because I live in a small town.
Well, not exactly.
You mean you don't think I could one day be president?
No, I didn't mean it like that. I mean, could someone from a small town be president? Yes. But you? Sure. But perhaps the biggest challenge facing the idea of another rural president is the issue of out-migration, leaving one region to settle in another, often more populated region, and small towns are no stranger to this.
I do think that out-migration is an issue. I mean, I don't live in Galesburg, but this is where the college is, and it's something that the Galesburg is having difficulties with too, and it's 33,000, and they would love it if more Knox kids wanted to stay after they graduated from college, right? But And so here we're beyond the opportunities that the high school offers to the opportunities there are job-wise, right? And I think it becomes more difficult for people to be able to pursue the kinds of interests they have in a rural area sometimes because of those limitations of it being a small town. On the other hand, in the era of telecommuting, if you're allowed to telecommute, you can be in Cuba or Chicago, right?
So, Mr. Brewer, I don't mean to be a downer, but Dr. Kasser isn't going to come right out and say that small towns are better or anything, is he?
We have to accept that there are no simple solutions or quick fixes, especially concerning the topic of happiness. It's complex. To demonstrate a researcher's hesitation to accept simple solutions, we asked Dr. Kasser his feelings about an idea known as the sequence of success.
And what is the sequence of success?
The sequence of success is an idea by some researchers that if you first get at least a high school diploma, then a job, then marriage, and only then have children of your own, you're more likely to have a family income in the middle or top third of incomes. In fact, they find that just 3% of people who follow this sequence are poor.
Ah, yes, the marriage before the baby carriage reasoning. So if you follow this, then you'll be happy, right, regardless of where you're from?
Not necessarily. Researchers often disagree, and Dr. Kasser is not necessarily crazy with this idea that following this sequence of success will lead to happiness, particularly just because of your access to income.
I guess the first thing I would say is that I'm always hesitant in one-size-fits-all solutions, right? You know, as a college professor, I don't believe college is for everybody. You know, I think that college, and I'm not trying to be elitist in saying that, I'm trying to say that I think for certain individuals, what they want and what their path in life is doesn't mean that they should go to college right out of high school. Actually, in some ways, think it should be a rule that you can't go to college right out of high school, because I think then you could go and you know, get some more real world experience, and you'd come to college with a lot more maturity, right? So, but again, I'm not in favor of one size fits all either. So you know, I think it depends upon the student. I do think that, and this goes to some rural issues. I do think that having a child before you finished high school is probably something that is going to stand in the way of your well-being ultimately. I just found out this morning that two friends of ours are getting divorced. Total shock. And so I was looking just risk factors for divorce on the internet. And I said one of them is, you know, having a child before age 18. In part because, I mean, it takes a lot of patience and a lot of self-sacrifice to have a child and to raise a child well. And, you know, if you're only 18 and you haven't had the chance to kind of live your own life yet, and now you got a kid and, you know, you're trying to give up your life doubly in a way now, it's going to really be very difficult. And I'm not trying to say that no single parent or no, you know, young parent can be a good parent. I think there can be good parents who are young, but I think it's much more difficult, much more difficult. I also think, you know, if I'm understanding what you were saying, I think that, you know, that this is not a solution for poverty. I think that poverty is part of what causes people to go off the sequence of success, if there is such a thing, right? You know, so you're poor, maybe that means you live in a poor neighborhood or a poor geographical area, especially in Illinois, where property taxes are the major source of any school district's you know, revenue. Then what that means is that if you grow up in a really poor area, chances are that your school district has a lot less resources than somebody in the north, you know, northwest suburbs of Chicago, for example. And so then you're not feeling maybe as engaged in schools, right? Because there aren't as many resources, or there's more turnover among the teachers, or whatever it is. And then you start to look towards other things, and college doesn't look as appealing. And maybe a baby does look appealing at a young age, right? Yeah. And so I think that I would put I don't see this as a solution for poverty. I think that it's a reason to rethink the high and increasingly high levels of inequality that we see in our nation, and that we definitely even see just in Illinois, you know, in terms of, again, you look at what the average amount spent per kid is, I'm betting, in Cuba and East St. Louis versus northwest suburbs of Chicago. It's like three times as much up there. That's got to be a major factor which is standing in the way of people succeeding, whatever succeeding means for them.
I like how Dr. Kasser emphasizes that money and success are often too closely tied to the ideas of others' well-being.
And success looks like different things for different people, depending on where they're at. Yet our methods to gauge our well-being are unfortunately, yeah, too closely tied to money or income.
I think that's the other thing I'm really uncomfortable with about this, is that it feels to me like that definition of success, not everything that was in that definition of success, but a lot of it was what we would call extrinsic, right? It's academic achievement, it's work achievement, it's about money and income. And for me, you know, to be a successful person, you know, the word success is so deeply associated with achievement issues. You know, we probably need a different word. You know, for me, you know, when I take a look at my students, you know, what does it mean? Is the student more successful because they got into a prestigious PhD program than that they're going and decided to become a starving artist for a while? You know, no, because what to me matters is that student following the path that makes the most sense for that particular student at that particular time in their life, right? You know, if this is the path of success, a student who joins the Peace Corps isn't successful per se, right? Because they're just doing this thing for a couple of years, it pays nothing, right? But boy, you know, they're out there, they're exploring the world, they're doing something that's really helpful to other people, we hope, you know, they're learning a lot, et cetera. And so I think, you know, we really need to, it's part of my dissatisfaction with the one size fits all, and especially in a consumer capitalist society like America, the one size that we try to make fit all is oftentimes an economic definition.
Okay, so economic factors taken alone are not the best ways to figure out if someone is happy. But what about success at school? I kind of feel like our methods to gauge whether or not we're successful students is also pretty one-dimensional, like GPA, test scores, SATs, etc. We look at academic factors a lot, which I know are important, but can we come up with something better?
Wow, awesome, awesome point, and definitely one reason why maybe you should be president. As we listen to what Dr. Kasser says about this, I'd like all my students to consider newer methods that better gauge our own school's well-being, which Dr. Kasser mentions.
Well, just to back up, you know, I think just to say a little bit more for people who aren't familiar with those indicators, you know, I mean, there's a lot of work that's been going on over the last 15, 20 years at the governmental levels, national and city, actually, where instead of always thinking that a nation or a city is doing well because it has high GNP per capita or the Dow Jones is doing well or whatever it is, trying to have a broader band of indicators that aren't purely economic. And there are some that are just measures of well-being. I actually consulted with the city of Santa Monica a while back as they're developing a brand new set of indicators to determine how well Santa Monica is doing. And it involves direct measurement of people's well-being, asking them how happy they are, asking them about their connection to parks and libraries and things like that, instead of just thinking that because people are richer that the city is doing better, right? And I do think, you know, and again, to me, that's the fact that we have mostly economic indicators, and that if you turn on the television, you hear mostly about economic indicators, is symptomatic of the kind of culture that we live in, right? You know, I tell people, like, imagine turning on the television, and just as often as you hear about the Dow Jones Index, you hear about the number of species of birds that have gone extinct this month. Or you hear about the percentage of people, of moms who are depressed, okay? And you got those messages just as much as you got these financial indicator messages. Well, then you'd have a different sense of actually how well our nation is doing, okay? And I think this also then, as you alluded to, gets reflected in the kinds of indicators that we use at a school level. So you asked about high school, I'll give you one just at a college level. You know, so when Obama was president, he wanted to have this new set of indicators for colleges that indicate, you know, that people could go to and they would see how good the college is. But the problem was almost all economic indicators, including things like salary 5 years out. Well, salary 5 years out is a great indicator. Like a school that has mostly business majors or computer science or engineering is going to do great on that sort of indicator. But a school actually like Knox, where a lot of our students go to graduate school, where a lot of our students go to the Peace Corps, where a lot of our students become teachers, yeah. Those are all low-paying jobs, right, relatively speaking. And so Knox ends up looking like not a good place to go to school because the measurement that is being used is one which privileges making a lot of money as the best outcome, right? Yeah. And I think that, and happily, there are other indicators that are out there. So, you know, we just did, Knox just did very well on a set of indicators that was, like, we turned out to be one of the schools in the nation that contributes the most to social mobility, you know, to helping poorer kids get an education and kind of do better than they had been doing in terms, or their parents had been doing, et cetera, you know. And so, personally, I think that these indicators at a high school level that are really focused on standardized test scores are a similar sort of issue, right? Especially when you take a look at what you know the politicians will call a failing school. Well, almost all of those quote-unquote failing schools are schools which have almost no resources because of the way that resources are divvied up in our nation, right? And so, you know, it becomes this vicious cycle. I wonder what would measures look like where the kids are asked, how much do my teachers care about me? Mm. How much do my teachers know who I am? How much do I feel safe at my school? How much do I feel like I'm learning the kinds of things I want to learn, et cetera? You know, imagine, or asking teachers, how much do I feel like I'm just sort of increasingly a technician who has to abide by a set of rules, as opposed to be able to teach this kid in this way like he needs to be taught, and her in the way she needs to be taught, right? If you're a teacher, you know that one size doesn't fit all, right? But standardized tests try to make one size fit all, and then if you don't make it, then you're a quote-unquote failure, right? So my sense is just like at the city level and the nation level, there's been this big alternative indicator movement where there are lots of different alternative indicators out there now. I think at an educational level, high school, college, and below, we need a similar, broader array of indicators. And certainly academic achievement should be among those. Okay, that's why they're going to school, right? You know, but it's not the only thing that indicates whether a school is making progress with its kids.
So, all right, Kaylin, this was a pretty cool experience. We got to hear from one of the truly great ones, Dr. Tim Kasser. In fact, it was so fun, we are going to revisit our discussion with Knox College psychologist, Dr. Tim Kasser. Next time, he shares about his work against value pollution. Definitely a topic all young people need to know more about. For now, let's reflect on what we learned.
I learned that Dr. Kasser knows a lot about the topic of happiness and well-being, and probably because he owns a donkey and chickens, among other things.
I learned that happiness is an emotion that is merely a part of well-being, and our well-being is made up of four main characteristics: feeling safe and secure, competent, connected to others, and our own feelings of autonomy. Like we're not being forced to do something that we may not want to do.
I learned that we should be hesitant to one-size-fits-all models of success, and we should advocate for better ways to gauge the well-being of our schools.
Yes, definitely, and one that is not tied to academic achievement alone, but takes into account those four characteristics of well-being and include everyone who makes up a school community. We have to explore this topic more in class later, but for now, thanks for listening, and please join us next time on Forgot Tonya.
Forgot Tonya is produced by students and teachers at Cuba High School, located in Fulton County, Illinois. You can connect with us with any questions or comments through social media by visiting our very cool webpage at www.forgottonyaproject.org. That has all kinds of great resources about the history and demographics of Forgot Tonya. Our goal is to create a space for voices in Forgottonia and across rural America to be heard. A foundation of our project is Illinois Social Science Inquiry Standard Number 9, which seeks to apply democratic strategies and procedures to address local, regional, or global concerns and take action in or out of our school. Join us next time.